Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Conoco Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We'll hear a conversation between Jim Krantz, the Lucy Awards 2010 International Photographer of the Year, and Henry Henderson, the Director of the Natural Resources Defense Council's Midwest Program. The title of today's program is Creating a New Energy Economy for the Midwest. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday evening, March 2, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and do not necessarily represent those of the Conoco, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Hal France.
It's my pleasure to introduce to you Henry Henderson, Director of the Midwest Program of the Natural Resources Defense Council. The NRDC is the nation's most effective environmental action organization that uses law, science, and the support of 1.3 million members and online activists to protect the planet's wildlife and wild places and to ensure a safe and healthy environment. Worth Magazine has named NRDC one of America's 100 best charities. Henry Henderson is the director of the NRDC Midwest Program, located in Chicago. He is responsible for their work on environmental protection, clean energy, and sustainable communities. As Assistant Attorney General for the state of Illinois, he successfully litigated nuclear waste cases regarding cleanup of nuclear waste, disposal facilities, and the transportation of high-level nuclear materials. He also served as founding commissioner of environment for the city of Chicago. He holds degrees from Washington University, University of Chicago, Oxford, and Kenyon College. He is from the Midwest and the state of Illinois, and we are honored to welcome him to Conoco. Please welcome Henry Henderson.
Thank you so much.
Jim Krantz is an Omaha native who lives in Chicago. He is the recipient of the 2010 Lucy Awards International Photographer of the Year. His work has been featured in Communication Arts Magazine, the American Photography Awards, the Art Directors Club of New York. His global roster of clients ranges from Nokia, Philip Morris, British GQ, Wallpaper Magazine, United States Marines, United States Army, Arena Ohm, and Johnson & Johnson. His work has been featured in scores of publications throughout the world. Krantz has devoted much of his career to photography and photographing the American West, where dichotomous qualities, rugged and romantic, violent and beautiful, encapsulate the spirit and history of a nation. From the cowboys of the American West to the Green Berets of the U.S. Army Special Forces to the inhabitants of the Forbidden Zone in Chernobyl, Krantz observes the strength and tenacity of the human spirit in its most concentrated form. As I mentioned, I met Jim a year ago when he visited us here, and at that time we began talking. I had not met him before. I found a probing, active mind and a caring and compassionate spirit and a project that we very much wanted to be involved in here. As we sit here surrounded by this work, I am privileged to say that isn't it wonderful when someone achieves the command of a medium that can speak to others and has that probing and caring spirit that will focus the work in a certain way. Even more inspiring to me is that this isn't just a personal exercise for Jim, but a process involving reaching out to make a difference. Please welcome Jim Krantz. Hey, buddy. So, gentlemen, welcome. As I said to everyone, we're going to start with each of you spending a little time talking about things that matter to you, and I'd like to start with you, Jim.
Thank you. The Forbidden Zone is a 19-mile radius that starts, this was the epicenter of the disaster where the meltdown originally started. So 19 miles around is what they refer to as a Forbidden Zone. In 2009, my first trip to Chernobyl, I walked into a village. The villages are basically empty fields. It looks like a farm field. As you travel through these farm fields, you see a house here. There's a little house here. And when I say they're little houses, they almost look like shelters. I happened to enter one house. And the door was locked. didn't look like it had been opened since the disaster in 1986, 26 years ago. I jerry-rigged a lock. I walked in, and I remember the first thing that I saw when I opened the door. Creaked the door open, and the light came in, and I saw a cellar full of bottles of vegetables, pickles, all tubers, all different types of things, really neatly organized, lined up in this little room. And, you know, you can just see the human thumbprint right there. And then I walked into the open space, and the way that most of these houses are, there's a little wet room, which is the cellar, so people can bring their vegetables in and clean them and do what they need to. Then you open into this other room, and it's basically the living quarter where everything takes place. There's a little oven built into the wall and a few windows. It's very basic. And you could tell that's, I saw dinner plates on the table. I saw clothes strewn about. You just get the feeling that someone left there quickly. And then on the side wall, there's a cabinet. And I call it an armoire. It wasn't an armoire. It was basically a pine cabinet. And I opened it up. And once again, there were remnants. There were socks. There were photos. There were little types of things just spread around. And you can tell somebody grabbed things and they left. But on the bottom drawer, I pulled this open. And I saw a little box just in the back drawer, like a little cigar box. And I happened to pull it out, and I opened it up, and just tucked neatly right inside of that box was that letter. And on top of that letter was that photograph of this woman. I had no idea what it was. And generally speaking, I'm not compelled to take things from places that I see. I feel like it's grave robbing almost. But for some reason, I grabbed this letter, and I don't read Russian, tucked it in my backpack, and I just sat and you have to sit and just take in the air, and it has a smell, and you just can kind of feel what must it feel like to live in this place. After this trip, I came back, and I Xeroxed this, and I sent it to Alan Potash, who's with the ADL, who knows many Russian Jews that live at the Rosa Blumkin home. This letter was given to them. In the translation, when I got it, Alan called. He said, "You're not going to believe what I've just transcribed from this," which was this letter. And it was so profound that, you know, I think about it right now and I still get goosebumps, because it was almost like I found a message in a bottle. And I still ask myself, it's like, why me? But it also, the fact that there was one, and it wasn't signed, one anonymous voice, it was just such a plea for home and about family and about wanting to return back to Chernobyl, and it was so moving. I mean, the way this letter started, I don't know if you had a chance to read this, but in the beginning it says, "At a late dark April night, a misfortune befell our Chernobyl, as if a whirl in a black terrible cloud, as if war broke out." And then it ends, "Yes, we had to leave our dear place, but we strive to be back. Dear Chernobyl, our lovely town, how on earth could we be together again?" Unbelievable. Just an amazing feeling of talking about a spot, whether it's a castle or a cottage. This was someone's home. And this was a victim of the relentless search for energy at any cost. And it happened to be the cost of this anonymous person. And they're gone. You know, sometimes I'm sitting here tonight, I'm just wondering. And I think this letter was written to be found. I don't think this letter was written for their sake. I feel as though, you know, they wanted people to, that they wanted this to happen. And I think the reason is because this was a terrible, terrible disaster. We all know that. 160,000 people displaced. So many people died. The city of Pripyat emptied, a city of 60,000 people gone in 3 days. But this is important because in my greatest dream would be that no one ever finds a letter like this again. It'd be great if that was the last letter ever found like that. And, you know, it's a big dream, but it's real. And, you know, and I stop and I think about Chernobyl, and it's so simple. And, you know, whether you live in a castle or a cottage, I mean, a home is a home. And it's easy to overlook things like this because, you know, these people, we don't know who these people are. They're far away from us. Hal just mentioned parallel worlds that never intersect. And there's things that happen in people's lives that we may not know of. And, you know, we're so oversynthesized with issues that happen every day. Fukushima, Haiti, the tornadoes that just happened today in Kentucky. You know, there's only so much room for compassion, but I was here. I saw what that was like, and I saw that it was really because of this nuclear reactor just blowing up. It was handled improperly. There's 106 nuclear reactors in the United States, and Chernobyl's really kind of a concept for anywhere. But going back to Chernobyl, there's so many stories about so many of these. Every one of these has a story, and I can just tell you a simple story here. There's a woman with this child, and I remember this. I mean, I remember everything, but. For example, this is a victim. In Chernobyl, I met this woman. It's unusual. People are wandering down a street. I mean, this street with a motorcycle rider in the middle of nowhere. You see people walking, and I'm saying there's just a couple hundred people, just walking nowhere. And I happened to meet her. I don't speak Russian. She saw my camera. She was interested in me. We had a little unusual relationship where she invited me into her home. And we went into her home, very modest, very simple. We drank vodka. And then she took my hand and she led me into a room. And I sat down, and you know, it's a dark room. She flicked on the light and I saw this little child. And, you know, it's a little breathtaking to see something like this. But she sat next to her daughter and I lifted my camera. I knew that's why she brought me there. She wanted me to photograph her. She wanted this image to get out. This is why we're here tonight, so we can see this. And I took two frames, and she covered her up, and then we left. And, you know, it's heavy stuff, but it's real. It's just someone's life. Fast forward. 2010, I went back. And the reason I went back is because I was so moved by this person's letter. I had to explore this a little bit further. It was just something that was very meaningful to me. I found this woman. She didn't remember me. I spent 3 hours with her. She didn't remember me. And they don't get many visitors in this area. And the reason is because she was inebriated when I was with her. And when I went back to see her, once again, she was drunk. And I found out that in the meantime, this 14-year-old girl had passed away. And, you know, there's like so many stories like this, but what I'm getting at is this is their home, and she elected to stay here and move back to the Forbidden Zone knowing that she's living in a toxic environment. And it's another unusual concept, not unusual, but it's a real concept. A home is a powerful magnet for people. I mean, there's a draw, and you'll overlook many dangers, or she knows this is a toxic area, but this is her home. It's very unusual to see all these people that have elected to be in this area because of the home. It's, you know, it's like they just migrate back, and there aren't very many of them, but that's their choice. It's important that I love seeing everyone here tonight listening to this. I think this is important because I think that's why she wrote this letter. I think that's why this woman invited me into her home, so at least we could be exposed to these people and their situations. And I will have more to say about this, but I'm going to just calm down for a second and let Henry say something. But it's all about stories, and it's just very real and very sad. And I think I'd love it. It might be avoidable to happen again.
Well, thank you. I'm really, really grateful to be included here. I am really grateful to be brought to Omaha by Jim, who cares a great deal about this city. And I think his remarks about home are illustrative of a deeply held sense of connectivity with this community and the community we both share in Chicago now. I remember meeting with him last year. It was the 25th anniversary of the Chernobyl disaster, and him showing me these pictures and being very moved by them for a number of reasons. We were looking at this thing, which is something that happened, results of something that happened 25 years ago. At the same time, you may recall there was this huge explosion of oil underground in the Gulf. And in the course of talking about these pictures, in a very short time after that, the Fukushima disaster happened in Japan. And what struck me about these photographs, and I think is so important about the work that I do, which has to do with clean energy and decisions we make today, is that what they document is that this thing that happened so disastrous in Chernobyl is not something that just happened at a point in the past. It thrusts directly into our present. This is a documentation of a huge footprint of the results of a few major human decisions that can have untold burdens upon a community. And it doesn't just go away. It thrusts directly into our present lives. And I think it's extraordinarily important documentation of how this actually works and the fact that we are making a whole series of decisions today, and they have implications for our communities, our homes, our neighborhoods, and our nation. And we need to bear in mind that a whole range of decisions can be made with an anticipation of how they will perform that are not necessarily going to be borne out by events. We look at the Chernobyl thing, we look at the Fukushima thing. Even the Deep Horizon oil spill, these are investments made by people, and you can understand why they're made. Having reliable sources of energy that transform our lives, that move us from an era that is indistinguishable from the way Roman serfs lived into how we live today, the desire for a rich and expanding life. It's what the drive for energy is about. There are a series of things that we need to bear in mind, and I think we're making decisions today, and if we look at how we make them without what, for instance, the Fukushima disaster was ringed by the myth of total safety. You get a repeated series of decisions by the government of Japan that they did not have to anticipate a series of possible mistakes. You go back to the complexity of running a nuclear reactor, where so many things are in a tripwire. And if one thing goes wrong, you have a loss of so-called fail-safe measures that can result in a horrible disaster that we see in these photographs, but are happening today in Japan and Fukushima. So part of what I was struck by is that these are complicated questions, very complicated issues and decisions to be made. And coming at it from my background, which is that of a lawyer, we tend to talk about it in very kind of wonky terms, you know? Subpart B of such and such a statute and the interpreting language of the Code of Federal Regulations. It doesn't really seem like a human decision. It seems an abstract sort of priesthood making decisions that don't actually connect with, you know, what happens in terms of the energy coming out of our walls, what it connects to in terms of infrastructure that has the possibility of failure. What if that fails? What are we doing in terms of making sure that these amazing burdens that extend into real people and still and are with us today don't actually occur? So what I really was intrigued by was the ability to sort of do a partnership with Jim about, you know, being moved by these pictures and reflect upon them about what kind of narrative, what kind of expertise, the fact that there are lots of portals we have to bring together so we can enter in as a community into the kind of decisions we need to be making. We have decisions today to be made about access to natural gas. Natural gas is underground, and we've got new technologies to get at them. We are on the verge of making a whole series of major investments into those. what do we need to be making those decisions? What context do we need to be making those decisions so that we identify what could go wrong and we protect against it? The complexity of the decisions bring with it a much greater difficulty of managing the outcomes. We have a public dialogue today which seeks to deny the complexity, seeks to make them a black and white issue, highly politicizes the decisions so that having even a discussion about it becomes possible subject of attack for not being interested in the economy or something like that. Or if you have an interest in the other way about how do we make a possible business decision in order to get at new energy sources, you can be yelled at for or being portrayed as being an unfeeling exploiter. The fact is we as a community have a whole series of decisions to make. And when we look at the failure of this facility in Chernobyl, it is a grotesque human failure. It failed because of human bad decisions. The intensity of the badness is related to the intensity of the bad human decision-making. That child that Jim refers to could very well be part of, we see there's a picture of a cow over there, a milk cow. When this disaster happened, the Soviet authorities did not tell the people this was happening. They did not tell them about the nature of the intensity of the fallout. They did not tell them about the fact that the cows were being fed tainted radioactive feed, that the milk would be tainted and radioactive, that the children they were giving the milk to would be ingesting horrible degrees of radioactive poison, which would cause an incredible amount of cancer and death. It is an evil political system. It is a lack of accountability, a lack of moral authority, and a human failure. You contrast it with what happened in Fukushima last year, where you actually have much more accountability. We did not see that happen with regard to children and people being told not to worry about it and to ingest radioactive poisons. There was a degree of respect for the people, and there was a degree of accountability. I would go so far as to say it was not an adequate degree of accountability because the decisions that had been made with regard to the siting of the facility, the investment of the facility, expansion of it, the lack of emergency preparedness, the lack of training for people to respond, these were all human decisions that were a failure. And they were a failure because they did not understand the huge burden of what the complexity of this energy system had to bear. So we have to go back to these things and see how are these human failures rooted to a deep moral concern and a moral impact on our lives in the present? And what do we need to bring together? And what we're talking about, hearing about the project of this center is how do we bring multiple voices together to make, to, you know, what do you need in terms of designers? What do you need in terms of technicians? What about artists, et cetera, to make a whole series of decisions together so that we are understanding the complexity and we're making the decisions appropriately? There's a lot that in Nebraska is being, decisions being made today, like, for instance, the wonderful Keystone XL pipeline. And I think getting at decisions about that, that look at some of the unintended impacts, the potential for human failure, and how do we make a decision and series of investments that account for the potential of failure so that we actually will not expose ourselves to harm's way. And that's part of what I thought was so compelling about Jim's project, was it got it into the human community base of what the implications are that we're dealing with. So I'm glad to be brought into it.
Another important aspect of the work that I have, I need a platform to communicate some of these ideas with, because collaboration is a huge word also in any project, whether you're in business or in this project or whatever. That's why the NRDC and HAL, it was important for me to be able to have a vehicle in a mouthpiece and something that could have, I can show you what the results are of the disaster, but now I need to put this in the hands of some of Hal and the NRDC so they can talk about some of these options that can take this further. But what I'm saying is both parts of this are important together to make change and get things done and communicated.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Gentlemen, thank you very much. And we're going to take some questions in a little bit, but just to sort of frame a little bit that as I'm listening to this, first of all, I think this relationship is a very hopeful relationship. It starts with Jim reaching out when he gets back and he has this body of work and thinking, I don't want it just to end with me. I don't want it just to be about my photography. I want it to be about doing something. And he made some very wise decisions. And one of the wise decisions, I think, is right here on the stage. And Henry's talking about all the different portals with which we must sort of come together to solve very complex problems. And I don't think there's anybody in this room who thinks that solving the problems of our environment in the long term is an easy thing. Everybody knows that it's laden with all kinds of levels of issues, from the technology that we have to develop to how you create it so that it becomes part of our life and the infrastructure of the country, and how you get past all the obstacles and hurdles that seem to be part of every process in which we try to change. One of the things that I think about, and I'm going to throw something at Henry, because I really would like to spend a little bit of time here kind of talking about how people and consortiums and experts work together. The NRDC is an organization that's really based on the principle that you need lots of different portals in order to solve anything in this. You can't just work on one level in order to get things done. You have to work legal, you have to work political, you have to work science, you have to work technology. And as far as this relationship, what about all of us? I mean, we have all these huge problems, but ultimately this just comes down to how will we live? How will we do the most difficult thing, or the most important thing, is turning over an earth to the future generations that's going to be worth living on. And I don't mean to say that in a dire way, because I actually think that there's lots of hope. And I'd like to ask Henry a question. I don't know where all that came from. I guess we had a great lunch at Hero, and he inspired me. And it went on. I'm not an environmentalist, as all of you know. Environmentalists get a bad rap, especially when you start talking about sound bites on TV. And what is it that they're terrible for the economy? Environmentalism is too expensive. We can't afford it. We can't afford all of this stuff. We need to continue doing the things that work. And companies hate environmentalists because they see them coming and they get all their legal teams ready to counterbalance everything they do. I don't think that's going to work. And in the future, we're just going to all die of a stalemate here. You know, that's really what's going to happen. So, Henry, is the environment bad for the economy? And tell us how an NRDC envisions the environment and the economy working together to create jobs and a better future.
I really don't think we're doomed. I really don't. And I think there are human solutions to human problems. I mean, and it is ludicrous, stupid, and unbecoming of a free people to think that the economy is at odds with ecology and ecology is at odds with the economy. It's all about the rules and knowledge of the house. You know, I mean, you know, not to get fancy or anything, but ecology means the knowledge of the house, and economy means the rules for the house. And I am, you know, maybe really, really old-fashioned, and I really believe in a fact-driven world. I dwell in a fact-driven world. I like to understand things, and I think decisions should be made on facts. And I think there are tools to untie the complexity of these problems. And if you look at, for instance, this week, we were able to get a closure of two coal plants in the city of Chicago. Okay, now is this a job-killing Clean Air Act problem? No, it's not. One of the plants was cutting-edge technology that transformed the energy system in 1907. Okay? If I start talking about this, I get really in the weeds about my admiration for the guy who came up with this, Sam Insull, who was a brilliant guy. He understood law, he understood economics. He was the whiz kid for Thomas Edison. He created General Electric. He came and made this plant in 1907. It was amazing. It changed life dramatically. But if you had Thomas Edison or Sam Ensel come today and look at this, they'd say, what an amazing opportunity to outcompete this clunker. There is a way to invest, create jobs, and make new things that improve the quality of life and transform the well-being of our community and make me money, okay? That's what Henry Ford would do. That's what a range of people who transformed the world as Americans did. Rather than slumping into a fetal position of protectionism and admiration for a bygone world, we as Americans need to thrust forward and create new value out of the opportunities we have. One reason we could close these plants with absolutely no impact on reliability, electricity is coming out of the walls, okay? You still push the thing in, your lights are on, etc. Those plants were unnecessary. Why were they unnecessary? Because we got in place in Illinois very, very good energy efficiency programs that made them no longer necessary. In fact, they had to go to the market and send the energy out of the state because they weren't needed, okay? And when you did that in efficiency, it creates more jobs than you had in those plants. You have to manufacture materials. You have to manufacture windows. You have to have people install them. It created jobs. It improved the economy, wasted less money on energy, and was a lot cleaner. So I think there are ways forward that are very straightforward and are things that we all can be doing in our homes, in our cities. Our cities, you look at the buildings, they are a major source of energy waste, which costs taxpayers, costs businesses, costs citizens, and we can fix that. And in fixing it, we can make the air cleaner and create new jobs within our community. So I think there's a way forward that is dramatically interesting, dramatically exciting, and in keeping with the American way. So call me, you know, crazy.
This will be a little of a pattern here because we'll shift gears for a second here because I want to ask Jim a question now, and I want to ask Jim a question that has to do with how his perception and his work on this changed when it was given an incredible personal focus that came in the form of the letter, and how he went back and did it a second time, and how his really imagining all of this is as being the conveyor of stories, of human stories, that would otherwise not be heard. How did you, as a storyteller and photographer, react differently when you went back with an extra something that you didn't have the first time you were there?
Well, the first time I went, I had no expectations of what to expect. I had ideas what I thought it would be like, but it was so far more dramatic than what I ever imagined in it. The word surreal is overused, but it was surreal. And you're dropped into this spot, and it's almost like you're on another planet. I don't even know what year it is. When I saw the translation of this letter, and when I went back, I definitely had a different perspective. And I was seeing things that related. But, you know, it's funny because as a photographer, things kind of find you. And, you know, it's more global, it's more expansive. There's so much to look at. The thing about photography so many times is it's not what you're shooting, it's what you're not shooting. It's a big decision you have to make. There's so much going on. I mean, everywhere you look, it's like you're in a kaleidoscope. And you've got to be very focused. My second trip, I would say, is more focused because I was very moved by the words of this person. I related to what it was like to live there. I saw the evidence of life in a different way. I saw the things that represented generations and families and feelings and the patina of life on a piece of peeling wallpaper that I might not have seen on my first trip. The wallpaper meant nothing to me on the first trip, but it meant something to me on the second trip. So yeah, your perspective shifts, and it was helpful. I mean, I don't know if I would have gone back another time. I saw it, but after I experienced the voice of this person who I think is listening to us tonight, I just have a funny feeling. Yeah, it definitely alters your vision. And, you know, I think any of us, anybody, not you don't have to be a photographer. You just have to be a person. You just have to have feelings. It has nothing to do with art. You know, we just feel. You feel something. You walk in and it's like, we're all the same. So, yeah.
Were you starting to feel that you needed to do something with this? And, you know, how did that start to evolve? And tell us personally, you know, why did you do all this, Jim? I mean, besides the exhibit.
I'm curious.
Why did you call Henry? Why did you call Alan? Why did all this happen?
I call a lot of different people because I need a lot of help from a lot of people. I don't need help. I like to collaborate with people. Everybody's got something to offer. I want you to ask that question so it's clear so I understand it again.
Well, it wasn't clear?
Well, I'm thinking about other things.
Did anyone else get it? I don't know. well, you know, I just... Okay, so let's... you've gone back a second time, and you're starting to see things differently, and you're starting to think about what this all is. Are you starting to already think about what you're going to do?
Here's the thing. This work can't sit in a box. I'm not interested in taking this to a gallery. I'm not interested... I want this to have a voice. This is bigger than my pictures. It's bigger than me. This is about other people's lives. The last thing I'd ever want to do is have somebody look at this and say, oh, you're looking at people in a third world country, and you're... This work has to be out. I mean, it just needs to have an impact on people so we can relate to it on a very personal level. We all wear shoes. We all have coats. My closet doesn't look like that. Theirs does. That's why I wanted to meet Henry. That's why I'm here at the Kaneko. And that's why it needs an arena like this. And, you know, maybe something will happen. I don't know. I mean, I can't go back and help this woman. I know that this man sitting on the bed with his head down has passed away in the year that I saw him. I went back to his house. I found it. In his house, his door was open and no one was home. Can't go help him. This woman who's blowing me a kiss, I'll never see her again. It can't help her, but it can help all these other people. That could be in Chernobyl. It can be anywhere. And going back to one more thing, this lady who blew me a kiss, this is interesting. Okay, creativity is a unique thing because creativity in the world that a lot of artists live in is making art. It's looking at things in a unique way, and it's having an exhibit, or it's figuring out a way to do something. For these people, creativity is their existence because they have nothing. How do you get creative? So the story on this lady, she's blowing me a kiss. I don't speak Russian. I understood everything she told me. I smelled smoke burning. I followed my nose. I found her. That's how I got around there. Here's how I'd find people. Barking dogs, smelling smoke. People burn, they cook, and they have dogs. So when I'd hear a dog and I'm walking through these fields, there's a lot of wild dogs running around in packs. It's a little creepy. But
wild
when people
boar too. Wild boar too.
It's a beautiful ecosystem. You should see how this has turned around. I mean, animals everywhere. It's just incredible. But smell smoke, follow my nose, end up at this lady's house. And, you know, people are excited to see someone. They don't get a chance to talk. And she was talking. It's like, I don't know what you're saying, but she was effusive. And it was amazing. And she took my hand. She said, she was pointing to her chickens. And she's like, so chickens are getting killed, is what she was basically saying. I know that now. You should see what this lady created. She had a bucket, like a big 36-inch wide bucket. And she built this thing up with sticks, and she'd lay bait down here. She lifted it up, and there's a dead mink. She was going to use mink. You know what the mink was doing? It was killing all of her chickens. She was creative. That's cool. But see, that's creativity used to survive. And it's a very beautiful form of creativity. I think it's an amazing thing. And this is creative. I mean, Andrew with the Kaneko, who did an awesome job. hanging this on a laundry line because it felt like a laundry. That's creative. It's a different kind of creativity. The way John Pica lit these, this, and he hid the lights. That's creative. It's interesting. It's considered. It's all thought about. But, you know, these are there's all different types of form of creativity. But this creativity is an amazing creativity, and it's a skill set most of us have never, hopefully will never have to tap into, being creative to survive. And I'm lucky I haven't had to do that yet. And here's another little idea. It's a very strange feeling to walk into this world and be immersed in their lives, very intimate, very private, very close. I can touch these people. And then I can leave, then I leave, and I'm sitting here with you, and they're stuck back in Chernobyl. You know, it's a very strange perspective when you think about this stuff, because that's going on right now. Right now. They're there, burning fires and cooking tomatoes that are radioactive. So, a little off track, but I think these are all interesting concepts, because creativity is a very unique concept that we can apply in our daily lives, whether it's creating a power system that can be safe and effective, and how you photograph, how you approach people when you shoot. That's creative also. So different forms, different outcomes.
Okay, well, I've got one question to bridge, but now my question to you is, do we have any questions? And I'm going to tell you that we have Suzanne on this side, we have Aaron on that side, and we have a mic in the middle. And as you're thinking about whether you'd like to ask a question of these two gentlemen, I'll ask one more question to give somebody enough time to do whatever it is. We have a question already. How fantastic.
My question is for Jim, and I wish my question was global and thought-provoking, but it isn't. And it was when I saw the shoe in this coat up here, I started to think, when you were there, what did you do for food? And what did you do to protect yourself?
To protect?
From radiation.
Nothing. When I went, I had bangs. Now look at me. It's not good. For food? I ate sausages that I, you know, you'd buy sausages in a store. I took some tuna. I'm not real particular. I'd eat with the people. I wouldn't eat the mushrooms. I didn't eat the vegetables. But what would I do for protection? Here's something interesting. That photograph where these two people are embracing, big mistake. I was offered. They make moonshine, and they make, you know, out of, they distill anything, and they drink a lot. I mean, alcoholism is a huge problem. And it was offered to me, and I'll drink vodka with anybody. I'll drink out of a bottle. For some reason, it was early in the morning, and I smelled smoke again, walked towards this, heard some music. They were drinking. They were partying. They offered me some vodka. And I said, no, thanks. It's like, no. You know, for protection, moments after that shot, I was on the ground, and I was attacked by a pretty big dude. And I'll tell you why I was attacked. And it was not a good situation. It was a really stupid. It could have been alleviated, because when someone that has nothing offers you something, you put it to your mouth. It's not a nice gesture. It's impolite. And it's... I don't blame them for that. I was there photographing them, which in a sense you could see, you know, when you hold, first of all, that's another thing. I don't hold my camera up to my eye. I find that very aggressive in a way. Sometimes I'm just like this. But when someone offers you something that has nothing, you should be grateful and take it. And it wouldn't have killed me. It would have been fine. But for protection, you eat the things that are offered to you. You put it to your lips, and you be gracious and thankful. And, you know, I'd eat what I found. I had to be thoughtful about it. I wouldn't eat the nuts. I wouldn't eat the mushrooms. I ate with this woman. I ate with a lot of people. And I drank with a lot of people, and it was fantastic. That's part of the ritual of being there and living it. But if you want to be safe, you should accept the gifts people give you. And it wasn't good. You know, it was scary.
We did have a question about timeline. Jim, can you give us a little idea of when did you first go and when did
I went the 9th of October, 2009, for 2.5 weeks, and I went the 9th of October, I think, 2010, same time period, so 1 year apart. And, it's funny, a lot of things change. A lot doesn't change, but certain things do change, and I'll tell you what changes. People die. It's just amazing. You know, you go back to these, it's such a hard life. When you walk in the back door, you'll see a big photograph of a man in the right. These people, I mean, you know, we're health conscious people in America. I mean, most of us are. These people live, they forage for food. They literally, I saw this guy, he was walking through a forest and I heard leaves breaking in this bramble bushes, and this guy emerges and he's smoking a cigarette. And when I got up to him and I started photographing, there were words on the cigarette. He rolled newspapers that he would find with grass, and that's what he was smoking. You know, it's not healthy. I'm not being funny, but, you know, it's a very, it is the way it is. And
we have a question back there.
So you mentioned it's great that you guys are disseminating the information to us and raising awareness about the issue. You were referencing the picture of the cow and made a reference about a lack of education about the people of Chernobyl ingesting the radioactive milk. What sort of efforts are being taken to educate the people of Chernobyl about the nature of the radioactive quality of the milk? And that you mentioned tomatoes and the ingestion of those vegetables and liquor.
They're all completely aware of that. And as I mentioned before, they had options to be displaced from Kiev to areas all the way around that portion. I don't know all the names of the cities. One's called Gormala, maybe. But anyway, these people live in the Forbidden Zone because they elect to. They return back to this area. They're all well aware of the dangers of it, but it's their home. They're like birds. They migrate. They want to be where they live, and they're willing to sacrifice their health and their future. It's selfishly, there shouldn't be children there, but their children's health and future, they don't really have a choice. So they're victims by their, you know, parents' decisions. But these people are there because they volunteer to be. They don't have to be. You can leave. You can walk out. And that's their home. So, and I can promise everyone there knows. They don't walk around to the Geiger counters. They know what happened there. They live there, and that's what their choice is. So home's a powerful magnet. That's what this is all about, home.
We have time for one more question.
I'd like to get both of your responses to your feelings about what you see as the future of the nuclear power industry. As there's not been a power plant approved for building for 30 years, and now there's recently one approved. Build a new plant. What do you think of the role of nuclear power as we go forward?
I'm not an expert on nuclear power. I'm going to defer to Henry. I'll tell you as a layperson, I just think these places need to be done responsibly. That's all I can say. That's all I know. I don't understand how these are engineered, but I do know that certain measures have to be taken, and people that design these need to plan for the worst case scenario, not just what's been happening over the average, because we can look at this weather we're having right now. This is unusual weather. You got to factor in different types of things, and I'd say in this most extreme case, and build it for that. But that's just me. I'd just say be responsible, but this is the man that will have a more astute answer to that.
Well, my organization is not like no nukes. But we do have a view about the industry. And among those things are that they need to not have the subsidies that they have. They are radically, fundamentally subsidized by the public. That those subsidies are absolutely necessary for any of these facilities, that this is a mature industry and that the subsidies are not logical for a mature industry. And if it cannot go and make its own way in the marketplace and raise its own money, there's a problem. And it draws money away from other things. And they are extremely expensive per megawatt hour. The mining of the uranium is very, very destructive. And there is no home for the waste. If you have a toxic substance that comes out of it that lasts for 10,000 years, there really isn't a human institution that has been verified that can guarantee 10,000 years of care. And then you've got this interesting problem of non-proliferation, of the fact that these are very... very dangerous with regard to the growth of nuclear weapons, which is why everyone is so obsessed with Iran and getting so-called peaceful atoms. So you've got this problem of overexpensive, no home for the waste, and the problem of nuclear proliferation. And aside for that, it's a great technology. About that, I just say one other thing. I was struck by. I'm reading this magnum biography of Ronald Reagan, and he was president when Chernobyl happened, and it was a turning point in his thinking about nuclear nukes in the world, and particularly nuclear arms. And he looked at the failure of what happened in the Soviet Union, the danger that involved. And he looked at the fact that there was this devastating impact because of peaceful atoms, and it as a guy who was very much influenced by parts of the Bible, Chernobyl means, it translates, wormwood. Okay, and in the Revelation of St. John, there's a whole piece here where a star falls out of the sky, smashes on the earth and poisons all the water, turning it into, quote, wormwood. He was struck by that and thought, perhaps this is the coming of the end of the world, and if we don't do something to change our approach toward nukes, we are significantly in harm's way and could destroy the world. And that very much changed his attitude toward negotiating with the Soviet Union and trying to change the way we dealt with the arms race. So I think there are ways in which very, very different, unpredictable ways. When you look at Chernobyl, a whole range of people can take different paths and think about not that we're doomed, but that we have the ability to change the way we live and make decisions from where we live, where we work, and where we sit that can improve the well-being of the world. And that's what I think is most hopeful about Jim's book.
Well, well, I think that is a fantastic way to end. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Kaneko Lecture Series on Noon Forum. Today's program was titled, Creating a New Energy Economy for the Midwest. We've heard a conversation between Jim Krantz, the Lucy Awards 2010 International Photographer of the Year, and Henry Henderson, the Director of the Natural Resources Defense Council's Midwest Program. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday evening, March 2, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Heike Langdon, Kaneko Events and Community Relations Manager, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Special thanks also to sound engineer Rick Weiner for his assistance in the recording of this program. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.